This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by the things we make. If you want to support Gregory Kamichuk, you can go to gmbkamichuk.ca. And if you think Justin Curry is just all right, you can go to chasingartwork.com.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I am Gregory Kamichuk, your host, here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork, and producer extraordinaire Dan Vadaban Kerr. Here we are, back in the studio. The dust and detritus of the road is off of us.
It's in a pile in the middle of the room.
That's true. There is a pile.
We came back from the road and just left everything in a pile for future us to
future
sort
us.
Out and
that's
do
right. Past
studio
us.
Is immaculate, I gotta say.
Yeah,
it's not at all. You can tell what time. See, some people are of the opinion that you should clean the house before you go on vacation, so you come back to a clean house.
We did. We came back to a clean house.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. How long have you guys been back for?
We got back like Monday afternoon.
Last week, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Oh. Not a forever time. It was very nice when we got here, and it was clear that a friend of the studio, Dr. Jonathan Ball, had worked tirelessly to keep it tidy, and then we arrived back from the road and obliterated
2.5 vehicles worth of stuff.
Yeah. I guess so.
Yeah, so take that, Jonathan.
He's not here.
No, he's actually on a call in the storage room. He's under an NDA on a project, so he's in the storage room having that call so that there is no chance of violating his NDA.
Oh, that's so cool. I love it. I love it. I mean, that's dedication.
That is. Good. Yeah, he's okay. Very...
Let's ask him all about it when he comes out. What were you guys talking about?
No, he can't. He's really good at that stuff. He's the best of us at that, I think. Okay, so we're back from the road. We are... back into the groove, so to say.
Day or two like after that 12-day road trip, book tour, Comic-Con, extravaganza? What's that first day or two look like?
What I hope it was going to look like and what it looked like were very different.
You planned a bunch of stuff right after, didn't you?
Well, I had no choice. There was just a whole bunch of half-dos related to... my kids, my wife, my house, some deliveries and some rentals and things that were just, well, I left for 12 days, they paused, but they could only pause at the most for that time. So
the pressure just kept building.
And so the very next day I was up at the crack of dawn and just going.
So glad I'm not a homeowner anymore. I have no patience for that.
Right. When our house was built, the Titanic had not yet sunk.
Ah, I owned a house as well. My last house was from that same era.
Yeah.
And now it's starting to my ex-wife is having some problems, we'll say.
Right.
Okay, let's go on.
Right.
But you, of course, are working in your house.
Yeah, we love our house and we want it to...
I love old houses. My grandparents had a house from the 1800s that I grew up basically in because I would go there all the time. And there's something about the character of these houses that you just don't get.
Yeah, the ghosts are friendlier.
Yeah.
They're from a different time.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. When you summon them in seance, their ectoplasm is a different color than modern ghosts, okay. Right? Who are much angrier and more resentful of a life they never got to lead. No, I don't believe in ghosts. I'm just afraid they're real. That's all. Right? So anyway, my day back was not the day I wanted. What I wanted was to sleep until 10, to wake up, to make myself a casual breakfast. My wife, who also is able to work from home, I thought we would go out for brunch and hang out together and we would get all caught up. None of that happened. Instead, it was just right back into everything at full speed. And on top of that, I had a bunch of client work that I had to do and some studio deadline stuff and a whole bit. So it's been nonstop. My first day that feels like a rest day is coming up on this coming Sunday.
2 weeks later.
Yeah, 2 weeks later. That's okay. When it feels
like. And were you surprised by that? Or was it just like, no, I kind of knew I had all this stuff waiting for me.
No, I kind of knew. You lie to yourself.
Yeah.
I definitely was, when we were on the road and you were like, we're finally home and we were pulling up and you were like, I can't wait to relax. I told myself, I too cannot wait to relax. I just didn't know how long it would be until
you have
I
to
could.
Wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, because I had school visits lined up right away, and I had a bunch of other stuff. So yeah, it's just been go, go, go. How about you? What was it like when you got home, you son of a?
It was nice. Yeah,
very nice person. I gotta say, shout out to Mr. Curry, to the Currys.
Oh, to the Currys.
Yeah. You were gonna call him a son of a something, and I'm like, a son of a very nice.
That's a good point.
Curry Country yeah. Living.
Having TikTok. Met both of your parents, it is a compliment to say you're a son of an anybody. Yes. Shout out to Curry Country Living, who has posted a video all about what it's like as outsiders watching Justin set up for his show. So if you want to see an outsider's inside look at our Calgary trip, you can check out the YouTube channel, Curry Country
That's
Living.
That's awesome. I'll link to it. I'll link to it in the
comments. Yeah, it's pretty great, actually.
Cool.
So while we were on our trip, while we were at the house in Saskatoon, the B&B Bros Fortress, I got a lot of writing done on my next book because I have an agent attached to this next graphic novel. And so normally the first steps of my graphic novel is I storyboard. I don't write an outline. I don't write a script. I go straight to thumbnailing and storyboarding and figure the book out visually. And that's just...
Because comics are a visual medium.
Comics are a visual medium, right? And like I have like the narrative beats are kind of in there. Like here this person is going to say something rude. This person gets angry, results in, you know, like just like little beats by beats by beat. However, because there is an agent and we want to shop this out to publishers, they need a outline and a full script for my graphic novel that is fully planned out in storyboard form. But now I have to reverse engineer my like plotted out comic into words, which feels like a big step backwards to me, and also something that I don't normally do.
Yeah, it's a gate that I don't appreciate either in this level of my career. Yes,
I don't disagree with that method at all. I think that's a good idea. That's the way to come. When you're describing this to me, I'm like, how could you come about this? You need to know what's being said.
Well, let me put it to you this way: I'll see your outsider perspective, and I'll raise you one, Mike Mignola.
Okay,
right?
That's an exception to the rule, though.
Is it, though?
I don't know. How many other people have done it that way?
Many. Oh, most. Really? Most who are illustrating their own
books.
But isn't
the Marvel method, I give you the words and then you draw to them?
No.
No?
The Marvel method is editorial, profit-based decision-making that then is assigned to a writer and then commissioned an artist.
But the writing comes first.
No, but you're forgetting. The Marvel method is based on extracting the maximum amount of currency from the stakeholders.
Okay.
Right? Justin is creating a work of art first.
Ah.
Look, Doctor. The woods are on fire. It's coming this way. We've got to get out of here. Out the back way.
We will. As soon as I provide that body we were talking about...
I've turned around. I've changed my tune a little bit.
Okay,
because yes, I storyboarded this book out, and this is a big book. This is not like Cassian Tonk, Rust and Water, Dragon Nanny are mainly visual journeys where...
And you can hold the whole plot of those in your head.
Yeah, like if they were to be animated into a film, like you're talking like a 20-minute maybe, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's a lot more that would have to be added to make it a full feature. This book is like a season worth of content. Like there are character arcs and many characters and all of them interacting and all this stuff going on. Like it's going to be 200 and something pages by the time everything's said and done. So much bigger in scope than my usual projects. And so when I storyboarded everything out, and tried to send that to my agent, and they were like, you know, you need to go and script this. Like this isn't how it's done, and try again. So, grumble,
kick the can, dust everywhere.
You have to understand why they do it that way, though, right?
Oh, we get it.
Not everybody is as good at visualizing things as you are.
Yeah, we get it.
The written word
It was put to me by a DC editor the following way. Editorial has no imagination.
Oh.
Editorial just wants to follow a plan. So provide them a plan they can follow so that they can answer to the people above them who have even less imagination.
That's true.
Right?
That's fair.
So on the creative level, like down from the editor, right? The editor is that perfect equilibrium where they have to be able to understand the visual plan. They have to be able to interact with the artist. They have to be able to manage those artists and their strange artistic needs and whims. But they also answer to those above. So we get the needs, but we're also salty about having to do it.
What has also been great about this is it's forced me to basically rewrite the book another time, a different way. By the time I was storyboarding Spark Chasers out, it was the name of the book, Spark Chasers. When I was storyboarding it out for this final time, it was probably the fifth or sixth iteration. And then I went back and I made an outline from what I'd done. And during that outline version, I fixed some problems. So like the seventh version of the book in that outline version got stronger. And now that I'm doing the full script, writing the whole thing out, we're now on version 8 and it's gotten even better.
Yeah. Good writing is rewriting.
Which, okay, that, and the whole time, what's great about storyboarding, what you don't use, I can still always use. I can take those lost storyboards that part of the story got cut out or whatever, and I can still plop that in the back of my book or like place it somewhere. Back matter. I love that all the drawings that don't end up being part of the project can still be part of the project in some way. Now going into writer mode and like taking away an entire town adventure because it doesn't really work and like what I wanted to say there, I can now fit into this other part. So we're getting rid of that town, getting rid of those characters. But we don't get to have that scrap of paper at the back of the book and tell people like, here's all the characters in town I drew that didn't end up in the book. Like, you can see that visually, but when you're writing and have to, like, all those revisions and writing, you don't get to take advantage of the way us artists do, you know, taking advantage of...
Yeah, an unpolished chapter you wouldn't really want inserted in the back of a novel that you read.
It's like the deleted scenes from a movie, right?
Yeah. Which are full of potential, but they just there wasn't space for.
And a lot of times, I just actually watched Constantine. I have this two-disc special edition that I picked up at a thrift store, and it's got so many deleted scenes. It's got like 10, 20 maybe.
Wow.
Like, wow, that's a lot. It seems like a lot. Usually there's like maybe 5 to 10. Yeah. But there was a lot. They shot a lot of extra stuff, I guess, and then they just didn't have to. It was mostly for time, I assume.
Yeah. But these days they would have just made it 3 hours.
Exactly.
Did it feel like too much? Like, did they give you too many?
Yeah, and that's kind of what it is. It's just this another, like, a lot of extra things about the world. Right, that world of Hellblazer is very specific, and I think they wanted to kind of flesh it out with a lot of detail. Sometimes you just don't have time for the detail. So they shot it, and then they cut it.
Yeah.
And that's what they do a lot of the time. You're right, they would just make it 3 hours these days, because apparently that's the standard for... Anyway, don't get me started.
You're already started. Well, so this comes back around to the idea of at a certain... To be ready for prime time, which is what Spark Chasers is getting ready for, there are different gates than if you're doing it completely on your own. Like if you're doing it DIY, you don't have to follow certain editorial whims and practices or standards for page count and page size and all these other things that are typical of larger publishers. But if you want to get on those shelves, you got to go through the gates that lead there, and this is one of those things. So this is not, I don't think, what we had this conversation off air at the B&B, right? It's made the project better.
Yes.
It hasn't made it worse.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
It's just a frustrating that one of the tools that he can show me, or I can show another person who is an illustrator or has done illustration, and they say, oh, I get it. That makes perfect sense. You don't have to then go and write 10,000 words to explain that to me. Right. It is frustrating if you felt like it'd be like knowing a language. It's like we know a language and we speak it fluently and someone else speaks in a different language and now we're learning that language in order to get our idea across.
Yeah, and I think that you don't necessarily need to change the process next time you want to do this. It's just now you know you're going to have to, you can still map it out visually if you want and then write it, but now you know you have to write too.
Yeah, I think the real benefit has been that like not forced revision, but like more versions of it than I would have done on my own. I'm pushed to like revise it again and again, and it's made it stronger. It's made it better having that.
Yeah. So when is this, do we have a deadline set for this, or what's the the plan?
I hope around this time next year. If it's not getting close to wrapping, there'll be a very firm date in plan or in, yeah, set in stone. Like working with the printers, there'll probably be, yeah, an actual print date established by now. Like I'm still working on the script, but there is also probably close to 30 finished pages.
Awesome.
And the great thing about the way I'm working, it's kind of like I'm building all the assets for a video game and telling a story with it. So the environments that I've built, even if they're not in the story the way they originally told, they can be chopped up and used elsewhere or still used in other ways, shapes, or forms.
So you can like use it to make a video game?
That is the plan. Everything is built to an isometric grid, wow, which a lot of video games were back in the day. An isometric grid is this set 30% perspective. So you
which
can,
does not diminish for those of
can
you.
Can I get an example of a game that would have used this?
Chrono Trigger, Zelda. Zelda. Oh, Zelda would be a good one. Yeah, and yeah. So the reason for that is when Zelda's in the bottom corner, and when he's in the top corner, when Link is in the bottom corner and the top corner, he's the exact same size. Everything okay. on screen is the exact same size, regardless of where it's placed.
Yeah.
So the game designers can take any element and plop it where it's plug and play.
It's like pixels, sprites, all that stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. And I will also mention, as an outsider here, these are the most complex, nuanced, and like living pages I've ever seen you illustrate. Like they're so dance with life that, you know, 200 pages of it, there'll be so much meat.
I think that's a conservative estimate.
Yeah.
I keep finding more awesome things to
right.
shove.
But I think that's so cool. And the other side of it is that so many of those environments, because Justin also works as a print artist, also have another life and another audience who sure. can just fall into those. It's been kind of cool to watch that.
So, but are you, you said you are shopping it around to see if you can get a publisher?
Yeah, so that's like the other part about kind of our business and the way we do things is I've primarily been a self-published author. And the reason for that is because I have access to distribution. I do Comic Cons. I have an online store presence. When I print a book, I print it with my own money and use my own advertising and marketing to get it out there. And then I go to shows, set up tables, and move copies that way. And it's been a pretty rewarding experience. I've done 11 books that way. And all my books have made their cost back pretty quickly and have made a profit since then. So it was this professional hurdle that I'd never jumped, I'd never really looked into until this last year. Like, getting a literary agent and seeing if one of the big publishers would be interested in taking my book and doing a wider distribution. And while that's exciting for a couple different reasons, I'd be equally excited to take this book and run with it on my own, do a Kickstarter, do a huge Comic-Con tour with it. So I'm in that great position. It's like I'm looking for a job when I already have a great job. Like yeah. there's no pressure.
Yeah.
So if, you know, after, and the arrangement that I have set up with this agent is we'll shop it around, but if it doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere, you know, we can just say we tried and then I can do my own thing. So it's not going to be shopped around for the next 2 years and in limbo. If there's not a bite pretty quickly, I think I'll probably just do what I've done with my other books.
So I've got two projects to, I guess they are currently unannounced, so I'll just mention that they're both with collaborators, and a meeting I had yesterday and a meeting I had today with each group. The great part of both meetings was, as Justin is pointing out, we're going to give it to our agents. We're going to see what our agents can do with it. And in a year and a half's time, when the agent has had enough time to go through that long grind.
We should also point out when like the agent is shopping around, the project only has to have that outline script and enough finished pages for the publisher That's to right. get an
okay,
idea.
Okay, so you don't like actually have to finish it.
You don't have to have it completely finished. Yeah. So you can work on it this whole time.
Where's the million? In my family's tomb in Zenith, in the crypt with my father's casket.
One big graphic novel project that I have being floated around with my collaborator's agent is in this process. And the meeting that we had today was, if the agent cannot find a deal better than the deal we can do ourselves by going to shows ourselves and getting it up there ourselves, we don't have to take it. There's no need at this point in our careers to just have another book on the shelf. It has to benefit us fiduciarily and creatively. So if it has a creative reason to exist, we're going to make it anyway. And then once it exists, what is the, you know, way in which you monetize it? It's a, such a dirty word, but, you know, we all have mouths to feed. But we have the luxury of that with both projects. And then another one, these are the people involved. We would pleasantly describe ourselves as not famous enough for this book project to be interesting to larger publishers, right? We don't move the needle enough collectively. But that gives us, we may not be big, but we're small. We're small enough that doing an experimental book project like the one that we were planning yesterday can't hurt us either. And so if it's going to be an experiment, we might as well control that experiment. We might as well see how it can help our careers. And we set our mid-list goals. You know, many of us, we consider ourselves to be mid-listers in the book world, right? We can sell a certain number of copies. What are those copies? What is our normal return on those copies? How much press do we get? How many new readers do we get as a result? And how many great interactions do you get? We made, literally made that tally and said, our goal as a collective is to beat that ourselves with our own media lists and our own plan.
Well, regardless, it's good that you've quantified it like that.
Yeah. Well,
and that you know, you have value. It just quantifies the value of what you do.
Well, we want to make it anyway. The part where this is also a devil's bargain, where all of us in that little collective want to make more stories in that world. We want to do it. And we kind of just wanted to give each other an excuse to make more of them. So we said, okay, begrudgingly, we better have a business meeting to see if it's worth our time. Right. And how will it work if it's worth it? We're going to make it kind of anyway. But what are they for once we make them becomes the second hat you put on.
The cost efficiency of short run has kind of helped make that a reality.
Make it such an important reality.
You don't have to print thousands. You can print a couple hundred divided by a couple collaborators.
God, and just see if anyone cares. And then if people care, then you pull the trigger on a few thousand copies.
Which is, always our advice. If it's your first book, print a short run. Yeah. If you sell out, then you've made your money back, and now you have enough money to print a larger run.
And not only have you made your money back on a short run. I mean, writing is so nebulous to begin with. The motivations are less external than you think. They're mostly internal motivations as to why you're writing. And so it can sometimes only take four or five of the right kind of readers to give you feedback, to let you know you've been seen and that they feel seen by the work that you're doing, to make you want to do a whole other year of work on a novel. Like that's sometimes it's all it takes. And then the business stuff becomes secondary. It's like, I know my people are out there. I know they hear me. I know I'm reaching them and they like it. Sometimes that's enough. Those constant readers are who you're working for. You know, that twinkle in their eye when they show up.
Yeah.
Cool.
Ask us more questions, Dan.
Like what? You're both looking at me like, you did say something now. I was actually spacing out a little bit for that last part, so I wasn't actually listening. Sorry.
It's hurtful.
I will listen to it later when I...
You know what's funny about that is I was talking about how important it was to connect to people, and you drifted off.
I did. I totally did. I was thinking about something else.
That's what irony sounds like on Super Pulp Science.
We'll keep that in.
Right? Let's keep that in.
It's also been neat writing, comparing to, like, if you stop traditionally sketching for a while, and then when you go back into that sketchbook, that is like those first couple sketches are like, you know, getting the cobwebs off. Like, you're just like, oh man, I forgot how to do this for a second.
Yeah, totally.
But you get back into it, and it's been like that writing. Like, I've been writing. I haven't done any drawing since we've got back from the road. I've just been writing. And so the ease of every day, it's easier and easier to spend a couple hours writing. Whereas that first day, I had to really force myself to just like, this is going to be garbage, but I just need to like get it down and then go back and revise and revise. And it's
that's actually a perfect segue into Meat House, which is I need to do that is what I have. I have to
rewrite.
I've just had to force myself to start. And I think once I do, it'll come. I kind of did. I did get a little bit of it. Like the first pages have been written of the first scene rather, but I didn't have time to really get into it. I got pulled away as I often do. And so I really do need to find a space of
both. Do you write? Do you like writing at night?
No. Morning time.
Morning.
Yep.
Okay. So tomorrow morning, what time are you going to write?
7 a.m. I can do it at 7 a.m.
At 7 a.m.
Yeah. That's a usually good time for me.
Just trying to think of what my day is like tomorrow. Oh, damn. I'm at a school
visit. No, don't do anything. I can do it.
No, I was going to send you. Sometimes it's great if you do a writing sprint. So if you have a collective of people and you want to do a writing sprint, you set a time and then everyone just texts each other and says, like, are you ready to go? Are you sitting at the table?
Oh, that's
are
a
you
good idea.
Gonna write? Okay. Okay, we're all gonna write. And then you don't check in after. Like, it's not like babysitting. It's just everyone knows they're at their keyboard at that time and we're gonna sprint for at least an hour writing and everyone is doing their task. And just knowing that your other peers are also doing it can be a huge advantage.
Yeah. Okay, let's do that. We don't have to do it tomorrow, but that's a great
Friday
idea.
Friday morning.
Not Friday morning, no, sorry.
Friday morning.
I have to take my son to the doctor Friday morning.
Oh, okay. What day? Saturday morning?
I can't plan. That's the problem. I cannot plan more than a few days in advance because I have so much.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky.
But we will find some time. I will write tomorrow, though. I can write tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning was really what I was looking at. Because as I started, I kind of played around with some script writing programs. I'm just using Google Docs for ease of, like, I can access it anywhere as far as having a script.
Wait, I don't have to be where I'm going to be till 8:30. I'm going to text you at 7
ahead,
tomorrow.
Go ahead, text me at 7 tomorrow. Go ahead.
You can see if you're ready.
But you're not going to be writing either.
So. I will be.
Oh, will you?
I will.
Okay.
I'll do a sprint in the morning for 45 minutes.
It also helps, too. Like, a great deadline trick is to get somebody else involved in that deadline. So, for example, with Spark Chasers, Sam Biko is helping out with editing and revisement and just general, like, she's a better writer, so she's helping me keeping this thing on track. So she has a deadline of June 1st for her books, and then she can take a look at mine. So I need to have a real solid, crispy script ready for her at the end of the month, and I'm on track to do that. And if I don't do that, I let down a second person.
Yeah. And not only that, is knowing that Samantha is also turning in a full novel draft while you're racing to cobble your script together.
Yeah.
How many novels has she written?
God, so many.
So many.
Yeah.
But if we set something up like that, like, when do you have time to read Meat House?
Yeah. Good question.
Well, for you guys, I don't want you guys to read it yet.
Let's have a meeting on the 13th for 13th Horrors.
Or an outline for me.
Well, I've already done the outline. I know the outline.
Okay, we want to see it on the
13th. I want to see the outline, yeah.
What outline? What do you mean? Like my plan for the plot?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I can bring that, sure.
Yeah. You're going to run it. You're going to run it on the 13th.
What day of the
you
week?
You got oceans of time. That's forever because it's like the end of the month. So you have the end of May and then June 13th.
Okay.
For 13 horrors, you're going to run Meat House past us and we'll help you break whatever's
all
missing.
All right, I think I might
the
be able to do
the premiere of Meat House.
Yeah.
Okay.
13th.
You'll have an ocean of time to do it.
All right.
And whatever you don't have done, we'll just make up missing parts, which you can
throw
away.
That'll be
keep.
Enough time to get something done for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can do it.
Yeah. So for the dear listener who's wondering what this is all about, writing is mostly finding a group of people who are your support group, right? Who understand that writing is sometimes the hardest thing to start and the most delicious thing to finish. And you just have to find people who will encourage you to do that.
You know what's so funny? I see that on a smaller level at CTV. I experienced it, and my partner, but there's another Dan, Danny, who does the TV side. So I'm on web, he's on TV, and there's a third Dan who works there as well, who does some camera stuff. So there's three Dans, and he will, like, get up and walk away from his desk and just find something else to do. He's like, okay, I gotta write my story. And he just, like, does not want, it's just the sitting down and starting of it, it happens all the time. And I don't know, I can't explain it. The reluctance to begin, but once you begin, it just goes. You can't stop it. So I don't know what that reluctance is, though. It's weird.
Yeah, that built-in procrastination. When you clean your house or do all those other tasks.
Yeah, when you know you start, it's going to be so much, like, you're not going to be able to stop, and it's going to be so much work. You just don't want to do all that work.
Yeah,
it's like hitting play on a movie that you know you don't have enough time to watch
yet. Yeah,
yeah. I did a writing sprint yesterday because we had this meeting about our other project with a group of other writers. And so, of course, I don't want to let anybody down. I'm trying to do my thing. But it came out completely differently. What started it is I was working on something else for a client. I had a break. Then I was like, oh, I realized the broken part of my new piece of this story. It's all a collection of different short stories that all sort of make this one arc. I was like, the story that I'm finished is terrible. That's why I'm not starting the fourth story in this five-story cycle. I hate the third story. That's my problem. What if I rewrote the third story? And then I suddenly had the idea for it, and I knew exactly what should have happened instead. And how it happened was I was doing art for a project and listening to the audio, letting a robot read me my last story. And I had an idea that was a better third story that spun out of the one I was listening to. That was my own work.
That's and your, like, the romantic part of your brain holding on to that first idea. Even when it really should be let go, it was there early on, so you think it has more
merit, more
momentum than it deserves.
And then later on, I was like, oh, no, the problem with that story is that it doesn't fit as
you
well as
you had enough
this
time away from the project. Exactly. Yeah, that's yeah. You brought up that Taika Waititi.
Taika Waititi, yeah.
Yeah, he'll leave a script alone for a while and then rewrite it from memory. And I've been kind of doing that as well. Like, I have older versions of the script that I know I could pull up, but I know they're not good. So I'm just rewriting
the
beats, and yeah. I'm doing a better version of it this time. And then when I go back and look, it's like, oh, yeah, this new version, way better.
Now,
yeah.
Do you feel bad you've spent all the time writing that story that you've just scrapped?
That's why I love putting in the art that didn't make it into the back of the
book. What I did with it is I really like, there's some great monster, I think they're great. There's some great monster descriptions in the scrap story that I've excised, I've cut them out, and I'm going to, and there's some good suspense building as it leads up to the reveal of the creature. So I've separated that out and put it in, I have a couple of files that are like, these parts are good, even if the machine is no good. So I've put those in that thing. I don't know where they'll show up again.
The housekeeper, the cook, and the butler said that they heard strange noises at night, and the upstairs maid swore that she met a man without a face coming up the back stairs.
So good writing is rewriting. It's okay to get editorial mandates. They make you stronger, even if you don't like them. Sometimes you have to roll up your sleeves and just get down to work, even when you don't feel like it. And if you don't feel like it, it can be really great to find a group of people who will hold you over the fire.
Yeah.
Right? So this has been Super Pulp Science, where we talk about...
Really? We're only got half an hour. We've only got to talk some more?
Yes, I want to talk some more.
I'm like, are you in a rush? Sorry.
No, I'm not in a rush. You, but
you felt like you were wrapping it up. I wanted to say, didn't you want to talk about client work? Were you joking about that?
Let's talk about clients.
Don't have any.
No? Don't. Oh, that's your advice. Don't have any clients.
Don't have.
No, they're good.
Here's a cure. Well, let me ask you this. We'll come back to around to it if you want to. But something I noticed, I was teaching digital media design and graphic design students this semester, and we came up to a conversation about where you want to be and what you want to do after this program is done. And a lot of the students came back with, I want to be a freelancer. Now, to be fair, I did kind of tell them about you guys. I think I had you guys speak to them at some point, some of them anyway.
I don't think we're freelancers,
technically we are.
They see it that way, right? Yeah. They see it that way. So they want to just be their own bosses, which I get the attraction to that, but it's like they don't understand you don't just get there out of school. You have to get a job.
How many people have the discipline and are ready to do that right out of school? Like, I wasn't.
No, yeah. I know. That's why you need to get, and I was surprised by that answer. I'm like, you guys sure? You want to go freelance right away? Don't you know I need a job to build up? Oh, no, I think we could be a freelance. Oh, okay, whatever. But there seemed to be a bit of a disconnect there. And I was like, that can't be the case. There's got to be, like, as far as I know, you have to go and, like, you worked real jobs.
I worked real jobs
until I got, like, I'd seen enough.
But
you know?
you've told the story many times where
grizzly
you're like,
veteran.
The money you were making from cons outweighed what you're making from your job. So you went with cons, and that was perfectly
right. It was a surprise that suddenly, oh God, my like freelance career is a thing. It like snuck up on me.
Yeah. Now, this is not to say that all clients are bad. This is just to say that at this moment in my life, I do not like notes that are lateral changes. And so So I don't mind making substantive edits when, as you pointed out, this town, I've solved that problem in this other part.
Yeah.
So I can cut that out and change it. A lateral change, especially in art, if you're working on a big graphic novel project, a lateral change is when someone says, can that character's chin be different? Well, it can be. What is the story beat reason for changing the profile of how they look? Oh, I don't have one. I just always imagined them with a different chin. Okay, fine. But this is now the seventh chin this character has had, and we have to go back and change it in every previous page. Now, it just burns time and energy for no change in the story.
Is maybe a bit of this coming from your overly busy schedule on the heels of a long road trip and
how much
lots
patience
of things
right
to do?
It's like a chin gate.
No, I talk to my kids about this all the time. I say, you know, Dad will never run out of love for you but today I'm out of patience. So it's like that, right? I have a love for the work, but I am running out of patience for people who don't do the job they've hired you to do and then instruct you on how to do it better.
Right.
If they could do it better, by all means, they should do it.
Well, yeah, but they still want to see. I can kind of see both sides. But Lyndon, you came over here. You want to say something?
I have a question or topic to begin if we're looking, searching for things to talk about.
Oh, okay. We have plenty. You want to come talk about this? But
yes, well, you stay there. We'll put you in, coach, in a minute, because there'll be things that I want to know. This is not to say that these are not perfect. What I want to say is that the clients I've been careful to choose in the later years are professional. They have a budget. They have agreed to their budget. They've paid retainers. They've done all the parts that make it fine to work with, so I can accept. This is just me, again, being salty about the same kind of things. We could be done already and have done two books in the time it's taking to do one book, and the changes have not changed the story beats or the outcomes, just zeroed in on one particular individual's choice.
Is this a symptom of a committee and somebody feeling the need to put their mark on a project? Like, you know, here's my worth to this project.
That's how it feels.
Yeah. So I'm going to suggest changes that are lateral just to say that I had something to contribute.
That's, I've seen that in at the world of advertising. Yeah, it's clients, a big, everywhere.
Big thing.
I mean,
yeah.
You always run into people who want to make it their own or do anything, even though, they don't know how to do the thing.
Yeah.
So they hire you and they think they can just tell you. Meanwhile, you can't read their mind. You can't see the chin in their mind.
And it'd be fine. Like as a direct example, what I'll say if I have a client like that, any client in any or collaborator, if I say, show me some artwork that makes you feel like the way you want the art I'm making to make you feel.
Oh, and you're then giving them work.
Right. And they do it. And then in this particular case, the clients are happy to do it. But then when I match exactly the reference provided, it's still, they want a lateral change.
Yeah.
So why provide the exact, I want it to look exactly like this. Okay, it looks exactly like this. Oh, we changed our mind. It feels like they're used to spending money on iteration that doesn't need to be spent. Like, I want to bring the project in under budget, and it's going to come in over budget as a result of too many lateral changes. And they're going to blame, at a certain point, my fear is I'll be blamed for it being over budget.
Well, you can point back and say, look at all these changes you made me do. That's pretty simple.
And I'll have to. Yeah.
Yeah,
so I just want to do good work for what I think is a cool project. And there's a lot of shackles between me and
that. Yeah, I think that it's just it is part of client work, but those are just clients. Every once in a while you get a client like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get a few at once.
Yeah, and divorced from their actual job here, they're all pretty cool people.
I'm sure. Yeah.
They're all people I'd love to just hang out with. But just in this particular pressure cooker, it's not quite producing the diamond they want.
My experience is the committees always scare me, because people tend to feel like they need to contribute, and if they don't have anything to say about it, then they've failed in some way, shape, or form. Or it's a very powerful feeling to make the artist change it.
I know.
Like, it's a little intoxicating to like do my vision and then come back next week and see that you've enacted this change.
And I'll actually point out,
times that by 12.
I've had that feeling as a art director on a low budget science fiction show where I drew the set, and then the next week the set was built. And then I got to point out things that were missing from the drawing. You feel like you're mad with power, right?
And now if there's a whole bunch of you.
Right. Yeah. So I get it. I get it. Right. So I think that was good. I'm glad you said that, Justin, because now I'm thinking back to that time.
There you go. Just bring it back.
And I'm just putting it back.
You'll get there again. One day you'll get there.
Also, too, like, just not, like, I don't know if this is the with these clients, but sometimes they just don't quite, they don't understand the effort that it takes for some of these changes. So, for example, in a lot of my work, color changes are really easy. Vector is set up that you can select colors and change them, like, easy.
Yeah.
From the client's viewpoint, they might think, like, oh, that's a ton of work that he just did. and then some other changes, like let's change the chin.
Yeah.
They think that's maybe something super simple too, super simple. Really.
But you have to go back, and you're thinking, in, as the artist, you're thinking in three dimensions, and you have to go back through every version of the character and redraw 80 them.
Panels of
that seems like something you should decide on before drawing anything else, right?
Right. Yeah.
And in particular, if a client provides models, it's easy. But if they don't and ask you to make them and then are asking you to make those changes after, it's... I mean, again, this is different because the project in question has a budget. We've agreed on that budget, and it's fine. It's just, for me, redoing work instead of doing new work takes some of the luster out of the project for me. And it's that luster that's going to make the project shine in the end as a complete unit. You know, it gets to the point where if all the luster is taken out, you don't talk about it.
Right.
You don't share it. You're not proud of it. And when people say, what are you working on? You don't mention it. Right. And what they want is the person who made it to be an active participant in promoting it. But if your active participation has been overshadowed, you don't feel much reason to.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what I'll say about it. I'm being very vague. Let's change the subject quick.
Doctor, have I got the rabies?
Well, I can tell you better after I've examined the bat's brain under a microscope.
That thing's got a brain?
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Yo, this is the voice of Lyndon Rutchenka, Studio Gremlin.
Meatball.
Meatball, yeah, my B&B bro name is Meatball. But I'm actually, I came over here while you were in the midst of talking about your students and advice you've given them, and we were talking about careers. And this is a question for the two resident professionals that I've been thinking about recently, and especially in the wake of conversations had on our road trip. How do you deal with, even if it's just a mentality of getting caught in the artistic, quote-unquote, glass ceiling, which is the idea of feeling like you want to level up but not knowing how to do it?
What is that level consisting of? Yeah. Challenges creatively or fiduciary return?
Creative challenges that would lead to, and again, thinking of your students, Dan, being able to create a career in creative work, find sort of building that that career for yourself, whether it's freelance work or it's client work or it's your own creative work. This idea that I think all creatives reach a point eventually where they think, I've done a whole bunch of stuff and I'm still not where I want to be, and I don't know what to do now to reach that next thing or what I should do next.
I think Justin's doing
Justin's whole brand is named after this, right?
And that's why I'm asking the two of you, because you've reached that upper quote unquote echelon of professional success that the people that haven't reached that point, like me, need to know what the how do you approach getting to that next level?
See the last however many episodes of this podcast.
Yeah, but hold on. I think important to. What he means by success in this case is that, you know, less than 1% of writers or artists in Canada are making their total living producing work of their own sweat and brow. And so it's not to say that Justin and I are farting in silk. It's just that we make a living completely based on the ideas and work that comes out of our hands and our heads, right? So that's the level of success we're talking about. Is that what you mean?
Yes, and the idea that, you know, you are not always in control of certain aspects of your ascension. For example, if you're someone who's waiting on a decision maker to get back to you and you need, but you're still like, that takes time. So there's work that needs, that you can be doing in the meantime. And how do you, what is the mentality or move, or how do you find what it is you need to do to reach that next level?
Catch
up. Justin, but what did you say of ascension? What was the phrase you used? That's the name of this episode.
I'll look back.
Yeah, we're all workaholics. And we got to, like, years before anybody started paying us to do what we were doing, we were spending most every waking hour making art with no real destination in mind. So when an opportunity came around to work on a book or work on a project, we had already put in hundreds of thousands of hours of our own stuff. So doing it for somebody else was not a huge leap in skill and production.
It's as much a compulsion as it is a profession, is what I say to people as a quip.
It's not great advice, though.
Yeah, it's not a great advice. But I'm going to write stories in the wee hours of some night, whether anyone tells me to or not, because it makes me feel good.
And so rather than advice, it's like assurance. If all you want to do is make pretty pictures or tell stories, keep doing it, and something great is going to come from it. And don't dismiss it as this is useless because I don't know how to make money off this right now.
Yeah, money is a byproduct. It's not the reason. Publishing is a byproduct of writing. It's not the reason you write. An exhibition is the byproduct of making a body of work as an artist, not the reason you do it. And it's self-archaeology. So should you avoid time with your family who loves you? No. Should you skip all the events with your friends? No. Should you not go outside because you have to make work? No. But sometimes the answer is yes to all of those things if you want to do it. So are you ready, Lyndon, to work whether anyone tells you to or not?
Well, I mean, I think to a degree that I have been doing that and continue to do it. But I know that from speaking to other creatives, and it's something that I did regularly, especially while we were promoting the Kickstarter we did, talking to other people making things, and especially at the shows now that we've had a couple great shows this year, talking to people who don't necessarily recognize the path or that there isn't a path. Because there's no one size fits all. You can listen to this show in every episode, and there are over 150 episodes now.
Oh, Dan, thanks for telling us. Yeah.
So at this point, you can't expect the newcomer to have listened to every single episode already.
True, very true.
But this idea that there's no precise science to doing it, and I've found that one of the quickest paths for me has been to listen to other people do it, especially when I've run out of ideas. And, we had conversations about this on the road also. How do I grow my booth, or how do I make more money, or how do I find this right idea? And if you aren't willing to listen to what other people have to say, especially people who are doing the things that you've done, you're not going to expedite your growth in that way. And listen, so finding the professionals, and I like to joke that if there's someone whose career you aspire to, or you want to be like them, the shortest way of doing that is look at what they've done and then do those things. And it's simple. That's an oversimplified explanation.
But I mean, I think that's what we did when we started out, right? When I was a graphic designer and nobody was paying me for illustration, I'd scour the internet and the comic book store, and I'd find artists that I'm like in love with their style, in love with their projects, and try to emulate them. And eventually that kind of gave form to my own storytelling and my own posters and stuff like that. And then eventually, after years of that, that caught the attention of other companies and other, and then they started going to Comic-Cons with it and stuff like that. But it was just trying to, in the shadow of giants and trying to do some of the stuff that they did. And after, again, it comes down to the hundreds of hours of attempting, some stuff started to click.
Find peers, and by peers I mean people who you think are at the same level as you with the same level of skills, and compare notes occasionally. Find someone to mentor you, someone who's above you in your career, and without ego, explain to them the reason you're talking to them is because they've done more and made more mistakes than you have even made correctly in your career, and you want to know how to do some things. And then find some people you're going to mentor. Give, pass that information down so they can skip a step. So they don't have to be you. They can get from the mentor that you're asking the direct information.
That's why he's hanging out so much here.
Yeah. Right?
Make a podcast.
Yeah.
Or make a podcast.
Yeah.
Or listen to this one.
Yeah.
All 150 plus episodes.
Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. But you can skim through the descriptions for ones related to people giving advice about writing. And I think that that's really worthwhile.
No, sir, you can't pin this on me. I'm not the bat. I've never killed. I couldn't kill. I won't take the rap for this.
You know, we talked in this episode about how both Justin and I have an agent. It's the same agent, and that person is representing some of our work. So once that happened, I started reaching out to people that I've known in writing and illustration for some time, who originally their advice was of no use to me. Because when I would ask them, how did you get this and how did you do that and how did this happen? They'd say, oh, my agent got that for me. I don't know. I'm just doing it because my agent got it for me. And so that was useless advice to me, even though I admired them. Now I can reach out to them and say, okay, now I have, how did you get your agent to get that job for you? Would your agent talk to my agent and give them some advice, or vice versa? Is it okay to ask these things now? Because we're apples and apples, right? Mm-hmm. Because everyone assumes, I shouldn't say everyone, there are many people who assume that if you're reaching out to them and they are famous in any way, it's just because you want something from them. And it's often true. And so if you lead with, what I want from you is a small piece of advice, and this is the advice I'm looking for, are you the right person to give that advice? They can say yes or no, and it's, the transaction is over, you know? And say what you want about Howard Chaykin, but every now and then I treat him as a occasional pen pal, which is just to reach out to a person who has done a lot of things in their career and say, like, here's some things I'm doing. Here's some books I'm reading. What are you reading these days? What's on your mind as an artist? And then I go chase down someone who has more experience than me, a different bread trail, right? So it can just be useful that way. Now, he's a polarizing figure in comics, so don't judge me by the things Howard Chaykin says.
Disclaimer. Oh,
Justin. Do you still offer lessons on your website?
It is still up there, yeah.
It is still up there?
So I have like a Zoom tutorial walkthrough lesson, yeah. I took it down
recently. Greg just said he took it down in case you can hear.
So if someone wanted to learn your art style, they can order that through your website?
Yeah, yeah. It's, I think there's a disclaimer on it. It's been a while since I've looked at it. I might need to take it down too. That so I need them to have a
right now
basic knowledge of Illustrator if they want to, like, yeah, if they want to try to follow along. Again, yeah, like, I think we get this question often from students and people at conventions about, like, yeah, how do you do what you do? And I almost feel like I'm disappointing them by letting them know that it's, like, the real answer to, like, almost all of their questions is hundreds of hours of practice.
Show me your work. That's really the answer. Well. And we have recently, there was a time when, like, looking where you could let a mentor or a person that might need some mentorship come sort of more naturally into your life just through whatever. But because of our association with the college now, and that has gone really well, we have sort of time where people are sent to us who have self-selected that they want to come into the studio and show their work and have a certain experience. So we don't have to, like, open the doors and say, we're looking to help people. There's a sort of a steady stream of people every year that come, and we're happy to help them, but we don't have to organize it from an administrative point of view, and I kind of love that.
Yeah, if it happened too often, our heads might get too big. I still don't think we have a lot of things figured out. So people coming to us saying, you've got it all figured out, tell me how it works.
Bad idea.
Terrible.
Yeah. We've just managed to stay afloat. It's like we figured out that there was room for Jack on the board floating after the Titanic sank, and we figured out how to snuggle up on there beside Rose, and we're still floating.
No, I think we're more like Mr. Magoo on the Titanic, like just chancing his way through all the disasters.
Chancing it? Yeah, maybe. But nobody has it figured out in publishing. If you look at the recent kerfuffle related to one big publisher trying to buy out another big publisher, and they had to go on record as saying they basically make it up what the advances should be, and they never know who what book is going to earn out, and they had to go on legal record as saying there's never been a strategy. We just throw money at it and hope for the best. It is actually freeing. It should be terrifying, but it's actually freeing.
Well, I think other people should maybe take that, like Hollywood and other, or you'd get better content that way.
Yeah.
Right? Because you wouldn't have to be trying to put things into a bottle. Anyway, we got to wrap things up.
Okay. So to wrap things up, I will also say I listened to the CEO of A24 recently talk about getting into the gaming space So I
A24 is a movie studio.
Yeah.
Great films. Yeah. Mostly scary ones.
They're not pretentious.
People who like them are pretentious.
Oh.
Oh, so I'm very pretentious.
You are.
Yes, it's true. And I like their content, but the CEO was recently challenged to say like, oh, so you're going to just adapt your movies into games. And he said, no. How our company got to where we are was we acquired, bought, and gave distribution to independent films with new voices and new ideas. So what we're looking to do is find independent games with new voices and new ideas and lend our credibility to their distribution. We're not going to adapt Hereditary into a game. We're going to find something new. And that is how you have longevity in a business that is supposed to be creative, not constantly redoing and rehashing IP as something into a new
media.
It's
like winning the lottery for that little game studio, but to have the potential to win that lottery of getting that big client to swoop down from the clouds and give you a huge chance, you have to be doing your own cool stuff and putting it out there. And that comes back down to that like advice of when you're starting out. If people can't, if you're not doing cool stuff on your own just for yourself, it's hard for somebody else to come along and give you the chance.
This is a good last thought for the episode, I think. In filmmaking, film festivals used to be the way that if somebody made a short film or a long film, they'd take it to festivals, they'd go through the curation process of having it in that festival, and distributors would buy from those festivals. And then that's how those movies would end up back in the day on VHS or DVD or in theaters or whatever. That's sort of over now, right? Video games the same way. The indies making their own games and releasing them on Steam is now the new film festival for gaming. And now a larger company can look at that game and say, oh, you sold 1 million units and there's just a 3-person team. Imagine if you had a 10-person team, what you could have done, right? And so they're coming in like that.
Is it Steam or is there something even less?
There's a bunch of lesser things.
Right, every system has its own platform of that kind of stuff. Right. So yeah, there's a great ecosystem for that for sure.
Yeah. And so it used to be that the slush pile was the same equivalent in publishing and writing. You would send blind submissions to a slush pile, to a big publisher, and they would go through the slush pile and they would elevate you from the slush pile and say, ooh, you are going to be our next big... That's over also. It's interns going through slush piles, if there is even one.
AI doing it.
Right. Right. And so that is, we're on the cusp of a new way of finding new things. I don't know what it is. Justin doesn't know what it is. Dan probably knows what it is. It probably is AI, but
It's not. You guys do know what it is because you're creating new things.
Right.
That is what it is. You're actually doing the creating, so.
Right. Yeah. So the only thing that we can do in the face of all of that change is keep making our own content and keep getting it out there. To quote Stuart McLean, as I have already in this episode, we may not be big, but we're small. And so that makes us nimble and able to do different things and test ideas to see if they will live or die. Well, this has been Super Pulp Science, where we have talked about how a genre gets made. Dan is grinning at me right now because this was the proper segue, right? This was the right time? Yes.
You're grinning right now.
We are back.
Cut this all out.
Oh, we are back from the road, and we're so glad to be back with you, our dear listener. This is GMB Kamichuk encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.